Okay, let's begin with our very important topics. Let's see if we can cover a little bit of each. I promise to try. No promises without success. Since this is a month, I'm sharing Rav Amital stories in the morning. So I'll just share a famous Rav Amital story when he met with that first bunch of boys, thinking about whether to come to the yeshiva or not. These boys were Yoel Ben Nun and Hanan Parat, and should they come to the Gush or not? So anyway, we have to finish the story, we'll turn on the air conditioning. So at the meeting in Rav Amital's living room, one of the boys said, Rebbe, can you promise us that we'll be successful? Can you guarantee? Amital said, I can't guarantee anything. Everyone guarantees go somewhere else. I was looking for guarantees and assurances and confidence. Now life is uncertain, and no Rebbe is going to give you the ticket to the Holy Land. No Rebbe is going to give you all of a sudden a clean shot. You got to work hard at things, and even then, you don't know if you have Siyata D'Shmaya. Kodesh Baruch Hu helps you. So I'm not going to promise anything. I'll try to get through all three topics with no guarantees. But maybe we'll start with getting some ventilation. Ventilation, I can promise you. With the air conditioning.
I was waiting for the story yet.
What?
I was waiting for the story yet.
Let's see. Did it light up?
Yeah.
Okay, lit up. Okay. So three interesting topics. The first one of which is obviously a Rav Amital topic. I'll go through very quickly. The end of the parasha ends in a great tragedy. Balaam fails at supernaturally derailing this march of Am Yisrael into Eretz Yisrael based on Balak's conspiracies. And then at some point there's an attempt to try to exploit a different vulnerability of the Jewish people. It seems as if Bilam was involved in this, although it's not clear. It seems to be more driven by Balak himself, but Chazal say L'chai Yatzcha, Bilam's involved. Try to seduce the Jewish people into an orgy of Avodah Zarah, into an orgy of sexual depravity. And because of that, 24,000 Jews lose their lives, and the nation is convulsing and is in great peril until Pinchas stands up and defeats this great peril, this great hazard, and saves the day and becomes the great hero Pinchas. And this entire orgy, this entire festivity was centered around the new Avodah Zarah, the Avodah Zarah of Peor. Right? Some do yourself a Baal Peor. Now, if you understand religion at its core, then you understand Avodah Zarah. We live in a monotheistic period. One of the great dangers of living in a modern world is we tend to be a little bit anachronistic to the past. All those people in the past that were foolish, and they were silly, and they just murdered each other with hacksaws, and they didn't have science, and they didn't have internet, they didn't have ration. The people in the past weren't any dumber than we are. They had the tools available to them that we, of course, have outpaced. And in 200 years, they'll look back at us and laugh at us at the tools that we use. Just yesterday, I took an EKG in a doctor's office to measure my heart rate and stuff. And literally put clamps on my ankles and my wrists as if they were jump-starting a car. I said, make sure you turn the dial the right way. don't send a jolt of electricity to my body. I imagine that my children, they'll laugh when they see pictures of someone sitting there with their jumper cables attached to their arms and wrists and little suction cups on my chest. Oh, that's how you measure someone's heart rate and heart activity. We just scan it, and all of a sudden we get all this. So we laugh at the ancients, and our successors will laugh at us. So it's really one of the great dangers of living in the modern world is that you act very foolishly when you're anachronistic and you look back at the past. And the world of Avodah Zarah is very compelling because a religious person wants to reach out to God, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu is unknowable. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is incomprehensible and is inscrutable. HaKadosh means Hashem is not holy, but you can't define Him. You can't understand Him. And all of Avodah Zarah is one massive attempt to make Hashem more human, to make Him more identifiable, to make Him more. It's not worshiping molten idols and not worshiping sea monsters. These are all avatars. It's good to live in the modern world. You could express their avatars. You look at someone's avatar on Instagram, not looking at that person, but you know that's the way that person wants to be seen. So their avatar is an athlete, or their avatar is a picture of nature, but you know that person therefore can be accessed by love of nature, or a picture of a celebrity, or a picture of themselves in some position or some city. So Avodah Zarahs are avatars. Don't worship in gold. The gold isn't powerful. That's ridiculous. Only the right mind would worship gold. They were trying to create a physical reference point, a physical set of coordinates for Hashem and Shemayim, and people looked at the stars as possibly being God's assistants and accomplices because the stars and the planets exerted such heavy influence in human activity. And then they looked at the seasons. These were powerful forces. They looked at the ocean. They worshipped who hasn't stood by the ocean and felt this magnetic almost kinetic force. Any Sydney boys here? No, we all have that. I said, right? Sydney's one big beach. You stand on Bondi Beach and you feel the power. First of all, a lot of people could use some lessons in Sydney, but aside from that, you also feel the power of the ocean, the power of the sway of some force larger than yourself. So the Plishtim worship the Dagon, the sea monster. They weren't worshiping the fish. They were worshiping the fish as some funnel or some identification point for the power of the ocean. So all these Avodah Zarahs make sense, even Christianity. Christianity is the most elegant form of Avodah Zarah. It's a, you can have your cake and eat it, two type of Avodah Zarah. You can see God as being transcendent and unknowable and visible, but there are parts of the Trinity that are physical and more physical. And the sun is physical, and the sun bled, and the sun has a name, and the sun can be sculpted. And it's a very, very elegant attempt to have your cake and eat it too. The great transcendence and unknowability, but also immanence and physicality and identifiability, and it all makes sense. It's all wrong, but it all makes sense. It's hard to be a pure monotheist. I mean, just think about what Judaism constitutes. Pure monotheism, no image, no pictures, no sculptures, nothing to hold, nothing to latch onto. And yet you're asked to build not just a relationship of faith and philosophy, but a relationship of emotions and love and fear and interaction. It's an incredible feat. But Pa'or is an absolutely preposterous concept. What does the Gemara say in the Sanhedrin? How did the people of Pa'or worship their idol? Very famous Gemara, we all learned it in high school. Source number 3, Ha'Pa'or Atzma Leval Pa'or Zui Avodasa. People would stand in front of Pa'or and defecate. That was their form of worship. They would release their biological waste. It's disgusting. It's humiliating. It's reeking. Could you imagine one by one people lining up to approach Pa'or and excuse us, I want to make it clear, urinating and defecating and vomiting. And it's just so ridiculous. What possible deferential? How could this be deification? How could this be a sign of worship and respect? And yet, like, don't be anachronistic. 24,000 Jews who lost their lives, they weren't idiots. They weren't morons. They weren't fools. They stood at Har Sinai, or at least they stood at Har Sinai less than 20 years old, but they heard stories of Har Sinai. They were really younger, but they were closer to Har Sinai than we were. Okay, they didn't have the internet, they didn't have Google. They had a more direct line of communication that was broken, yet they fell prey to this. So Rav Amital felt that Pa'or was predicated from the following premise, this alliteration. Pa'or was predicated from the following preposterous premise. What was the premise of Pa'or? Anything natural is holy. If something is natural, then it has to be pure and noble and holy and sacred. Even defecation. Defecation wasn't chosen for the act itself. Defecation was hyperbolic. Even defecation can be holy, no matter what, because every homeostatic being eats, and every homeostatic being has to live off of some oxygenation process to create energy, at least to consuming, not necessarily plants, but moving, living organisms. They move and they're mobile and burn it, even plants to create energy. And the creation of energy is going to create wastes. And how you dispose of those wastes is crucial to the homeostasis, survivability, and viability of an organism, even a small organism, a paramecium or a mitochondria. You have to relieve your wastes. When people suffer kidney failure, chas v'shalom, or inability to physically remove their wastes, the entire system can collapse. How do you remove the waste? It's totally natural. It's built into nature. Those are the wheels and nuts and bolts of nature, relieving waste. Nothing embarrassing about it. You're living, you're leaving your waste. And even that could be holy, because the entire natural world is holy. And that's really seductive, because there is a part of us that feels that emotions, values, experiences that are natural are holy. There's something unique about them. You walk across a landscape, we visit a mountain, we see a river, we see something pristine, untainted by human hand, uncorrupted by urban life, pure as Hashem. There's a certain sense of purity and nobility and sanctity we associate with things. Return me back to my ritual state of innocence. But you have to know how to discern. It's not always easy to discern. And you think that Pa'or concluded thousands of years ago. It didn't. We still live in Pa'or. We still live in Pa'or land. We still live in Pa'orsville. And you'd be surprised about the extreme disfigured manifestations of power, which you just buy into. Because if it's natural, it must be holy. We don't filter, we don't select. How many times have you seen the following movie? I'm not going to tell you the name of the movie, but I'll describe the plot line, and I imagine you've seen at least five of each of these plot lines. A woman, single mother, raising a child, deadbeat father, no way to earn a living, a child comes home from school with a torn knapsack, not enough school books, parents are making fun of the child, she has to earn a living, she becomes a prostitute. But you're rooting for her. Why? Because the maternal instinct to protect and raise her child is so pure and natural, but it's more natural than the love of a mother for a baby for a child. You ignore the fact she's a moral degenerate. Or the hitman, the Italian hitman who listens to Mozart and sips on vintage wine and is kind to his neighbors. He whacks people for a living, but we won't mention that because he's evoking natural life, music, and elegance, and good neighborly, and it's kind-hearted. And how many times have you seen the following? Maybe it didn't see somebody of those plot lines. What about this plot line? A woman is locked into a marriage with an offensive, ugly, obese husband who can't shoot straight, maybe even abusive, throwing a little of that spice. And then she starts a romance with her coworker, the mailman, the person she meets at the gym. And now Hollywood is setting up a rivalry, a competition between two forms of love. Moral love, marital love, legal love, and natural love. Because, you know, natural love with her, an abusive husband, natural love with a co-worker she's attracted to, and to the other kind of person. Now, who are you rooting? You're rooting for the adulterer every time. You're rooting for the novel. And of course, the one who plays the adulterer is slim and attractive, and the star who plays an abusive husband is generally intended in the deck of staff. You don't stop yourself. No, this is wrong. How many billions of dollars has Disney profited from that one phrase called natural love, true love? If it's natural, it can defy all moral. I hope that every one of you in your life at some point, not everyone, but maybe a large portion of you, will have the courage and the readiness to seek psychological counseling. We live in a very, very difficult world. Psychological counseling shouldn't be seen as only the province of fruit cups and nuts and people who are off the wood. We live in a very, very emotionally taxing world. And just like you'd see a professional about a medical issue, when you feel that your emotions and your psyche isn't right, you want to see someone who has tools and at least terminology and can help you. We're sitting at the table Friday night with my family, and we're playing a card game. It was a Hebrew card game that was given out, basically asking very personal questions, some personal, some trivial, basically different types of questions, and you went around and just got whatever card. You had to answer the question. No, this is, I'm sure there are games like that. And we're playing these little cards. The show handed it out a few years ago, so of course everyone's laughing at me because I'm Abba, so I get all the embarrassing cards. I get a card. What's your major regret in life or something like that? Things you could do over something. You know, my kid's got the easy one. Like, what's your favorite ketchup? Right? I get the deep psychological question. Yeah, great. My kid's probably stacked the deck before me. I thought a little. Like, I don't want to answer this. I wish I would have consulted with psychologists at certain points in my life when I was facing certain issues. Like, I don't think it was traumatic. I don't think it was devastating. But I could have done better if I had a little more guidance, a little more self-awareness. But a lot of modern psychology is predicated upon the notion of you're only acting out your inner self. It's getting you more in touch with your true natural self without all these corruptions and restraints and laws and coercions of society. That's what's really rooting you. You're not responsible. If you're a murderer, just act out your inner murderer. It's not really your fault. It's your nanny's fault for diapering you too tightly. And it's your second grade teacher's fault for scolding you. Your Rebbe's fault in yeshiva. It's everyone else's fault. And just be true to yourself. That's why if you ask me one of the most important professions that Orthodox people can enter, aside from chinuch, which is absolutely crucial and important professions, is psychology. Because you have to know how to thread the needle. You have to know how to study modern psychology and apply it, because it's given us a real keyhole to the human psyche. But also know how to calibrate it with Torah and Torah values, and not just a free-for-all. It's not just... And yeah, sometimes when boys or girls ask me about psychological counseling, they don't always have to seek Orthodox Jews or psychologists, but at least people who know that field and be respectful of religion. They're going to offer guidance that will take both into account rather than hearing two voices. I'm schizophrenic. I'm sure when I'm davening, I feel the chorus, and then all of a sudden, psychology is a whole new set of values. It's a waste of your time and money not to try to fuse and immerse it. So there's a lot of power in our world. And to be honest, there should be ideas that enchant us towards the territory of power. Rav Amital spends so much time, you can look it up in Baruch Hashem, they have them speaking about normalcy and natural feelings. And if you have a natural feeling, and how do you discern natural feelings that dovetail with the Kaddish Baruch Hu's Ratzon? And natural feelings and natural impulse. Everyone has natural feelings. What? You don't want to kiss your girlfriend. You're not a red-blooded Australian. You're not normal. It wasn't normal. Now, Kaddish Baruch Hu gives us natural impulses. And I believe that there's always a moment for those impulses to be expressed, but at certain times, to certain degrees, in certain contexts, Hashem wants us to apply restraint and impose His will upon our will, because that is our will. That is better for our will. And that takes a leap of faith, and that takes a little intellectual and religious humility. And so that's why Pa'or was so seductive. And that's why, strangely, so much of Sefer Devarim, which is a review and a summary of the Torah, happens at Arvos Moav, that's one set of geotag, but it also happens overlooking Pa'or. Take a look at some of the psukim in Devarim. First, in Devarim itself, Hashem tells Moshe to ascend, source number 4. Sayyidacha, Yama, Tzafana, Temana, Mizracha, Tzavis, Yeshua. This is the introduction before Moshe's going to rattle off the whole Torah. And where are we standing? Where are we placed? Vanesha, Bagai, source 4. Mol base par. What cares about base par? Base par is already finished. It's back in Balak. We're now in Devarim. Why are we positioned? Station, because the Torah that Moshe is about to repeat is literally mul beis Pa'or. It is defying the whispers of Pa'or. The geography reflects the morality. Mul beis Pa'or. This zos ha-Torah, and the Torah repeats in Parshas Veschanan, Asher sam Moshe asoros vay, but neben Yisrael, Eila, Eidos, again, a long-winded introduction, including the Dibash Moshe vayisrael, then Eivar, again, Nachamol, Bagai, Mol, Base, Pa'or. Why is it? It's something you'd like to forget. It's more not a place you want to remember. It's like saying, we were near Auschwitz. You don't want to mention it 1,000 times. And this is, of course, not. This is a moral guilt, Base, Pa'or. Don't mention it. Everything comes in. Not every place you visit has to be mentioned. And finally, we don't know where Moshe is buried. But the only set of coordinates we have about Moshe's burial, source number 6, Vayam Hashem Moshe Eben Hashem. Eretz Moav al pi Hashem, vayikvor asav bagai, Eretz Moav. They're always based, I can't get that base bar, wherever they are. Moshe's buried, mul base bar. So here, of course, the Gemara notes, it's source number 2. Amar b'chama b'chanina, mipnei ma nikvar Moshe eitzel base bar, kedei lechaper al maiseh bar. Moshe's death is a kapara. All the rebellions and all the failures in the desert. Egel, Miraglin, Korach, Asaf Suf, Tava, Kibros HaTava. Of all the tragedies, why is Moshe's death a kapara for a baseball? It's one of the string of tragedies. Why is that so acted out? Because that is, in many ways, the most dangerous one, because it suggested some very seductive notions about religion, which Moshe's Torah was meant to debunk. Torah is, you have natural feelings, but I wish Baruch wants you to impose moral will, divine instruction, restraint, but not to eliminate natural feelings. And how do you find this? Not always so easy. Not always so easy. It's today, boy, in my shir, asked me on the way out of shir. At what point can you dislodge halacha calculus because it doesn't feel right to you? So I said, well, one time you can. It's a famous story from Amital. I'm sure you've heard this story before. A person's stranded on a desert island, has to eat something to survive, as either, never knew what a desert island is, but either a desert or an island. There are too many islands in the desert. But either a desert or an island. They can only eat one of two things. My favorite desert island story a couple of years ago. We had a tish for the Rabbanim. Not for the guys at the end of the year, so we had a panel of Rabbanim. So one guy, after all these questions about life, what should we do when we get back to college, and Torah Ramada, and Israel, and this and that, and one of the guys wanted to lighten up the whole tish, so he said, if you were stuck on a desert island, what book would you bring? So one answer was more sacred and rabbinic than the next. Oh, I bring the Rambam, and I bring the Ramban, and I bring the Minchas Chinuch, and I bring the Sefer Torah, and I bring the Bar Ilan with my computer. Like, oh my goodness. And they didn't tell me I'd have to sit on rabbi panels, and I became a rabbi. whoa, too heavy for me. So I can't say my answer, my choice, that if I were stuck on a desert island and I had one book to bring, it would definitely be How to Build a Ship. That would be my book. I'm not bringing Minchas Chinuch, I'm not bringing Rambans. I'm bringing shipbuilding 101, shipbuilding for dummies or something. You know, IKEA's how to glue in the parts. I'm getting off the Minchas Chinuch on the island. I gotta know which book to bring, okay? But I can't imagine the ship would help me on the desert. But let's say you're a desert island, you have a choice to eat pig meat or the meat of a survivor from the crash. What's the dilemma? If you parse this from a purely halachic standpoint, pig meat is more forbidden than human flesh. Now, purely halachically, you should eat human flesh because it's less forbidden. And Rami tells him, no, here you have the right to say that from a moral human standpoint, human flesh is repugnant, and if we eat the pig meat, even though it's more so. And of course, Rav Aaron famously disagreed, which highlights the difference between the two. But that's not a case where you're dislodging halacha because of moral sensibilities. That's a case we have to violate an isser anyway, the chayva, the mitzvah, to eat something which is us. If you don't, you're a mitzvah. If you die unnecessarily, you're chayv misa twice. You have to save your life with food. You have to eat something us. You don't have a choice. The question is, when you have to do an avera, should the calculus be, as the Gemara says, in Yom HaMachilim Nosa HaKal HaKal Kod, if you eat the lightest isser, in this case, it would be the human flesh, or can you say something, violating an isser anyway, I'll eat a more chamer isser, which is less morally disgusting and impulsive. But you can't say, oh, there's a mitzvah here and my sensibilities just don't accept it, and therefore. Second thing I told the boys, it could be that if you find all sorts of shittas yachids that support the direction you want to take. I gave you an example, once to visit a 95-year-old woman in the question of nichol. So of course it doesn't feel right to worry about nichol and missing a 95-year-old woman. But the halacha is halacha. So you can say, normally we pasuk like this shita that you can't be mekel for yichud in this area, and normally pasuk like this shita. But in this case, because it's a 95-year-old grandmother or a great grandmother, so I'll be mekel like this shita. So I'll find this, because that's the purpose. We are operating within the halachic system, and you're drawing options in halacha that don't always dictate the conclusion. But in this case, because it's so obvious, you'll apply the sniff halacha of the shita. You can't just oppose halacha; it doesn't feel right to you. That's called the Akedah. Truly, the Akedah didn't feel right to Avraham. Not only can it shouldn't feel right, it feels right, becomes a monster. But the basic ABCs of halacha is that you don't always know. When you subject Hashem's rights, you try to understand as much as you can. And we just learned Basar B'Challah this week, and you share with God, understand why Basar B'Challah is us. You can tell me from today until tomorrow what Basar represents or Challah represents. I'll be Kabbalah, maybe, but in the world of Ration, I don't know everything. So that's the first thing I wanted to speak about tonight, the seduction and the appeal of Thor. Second issue, make sure we're budgeting somewhere near. Okay, I'm going to get through two, maybe a little more. Kilo nachash b'Yakov v'lo kesen b'Yisrael. Kreisi amel b'Yakov v'Yisrael ma'pa'aleh. Source number base. Bilam was a sorcerer. Bilam was a wizard. Bilam employed black magic. Necromancy, speaking, consulting with the dead, invoking the dead, predicting the future. And somehow he realizes there's something about this people that's different. And of course what Bilam notices in Parshas Balak is actually enshrined halachically in Parshas Re. Why? Why is Nichush trying to predict the future? It's not just us. Bilam said, oh, these people. He didn't say, oh, the Nechron Shabbos. Ooh, the Nani Basar B'Chachav. There's something very core here, fundamental, about Bilam the sorcerer, Bilam the predictor, Bilam trying to be the soothsayer, the necromancer, the future predictor. Say, well, they're not, you are. Maybe you've got the upper hand on them. Maybe you've got the future in your pocket, and they don't. What is so antithetical about nachash and nichosh and prediction.
And it makes you think that you're all under control. Or you can do things yourself.
Okay, so we'll talk about that in a moment. Keshuv and Hashem. But let's start from a more basic level and work our way up. Three things. First of all, there's something about being a Jew and recognizing that you're a ben melech. And this whole world is not a world of elegance, not a world of fine, noble behavior. It's a world of witchcraft and animals and blood and flesh and dark forces. And it's not the place for a good yeshiva bachur to be in a witch's den. The good things aren't happening there. Animals are being slaughtered and sliced, and blood is being tossed around, and devils, and dark. Oh, it's hard to convey to you. I was telling my son this the other day. We don't really live in a world of black magic. Magicians today are just professional sleight of hand. Move the shield this way, cut the lady this way. They're not real. There was a world of black magic. The Egyptian Khartoumim practiced black magic. Jesus practiced magic. He walked on water and he performed real magic, real changing and consistency. We don't really live in that world anymore. But that world is a very powerful world. It's really not a world that Hashem wants us to be too much a part of. It's not going to do much for our elegance and our nobility and our cleanliness and our dignity. Part of being a Ben Torah is dignity. Not pompousness, not arrogance, not holier than thou. It's very important not to become too detached and too supercilious and too haughty. But to know there are times you're standing in front of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Bacha Bachar Hashem, Shebachar Bano Mikol Amin. In the Haredi world, it's a little bit why they dress that way, with the white shirt and black pants. It's not Shabbos, but we're the Amon Yifchar, we're B'nai Torah, we're Yeshiva Bachar, we were chosen. We have to, okay, it carries a cost of being separatist, but the whole point of being separatist, I'm sure it's a little different. So even if you don't express it in different styles of dress, you have to express yourself in table manners, how you conduct yourself at the table. You know, not recommending all of a sudden five forks and six knives and three different goblets, and all of a sudden everyone eats like the Buckingham Palace, but I remember once I was driving home, and I used to stay with my parents in Brooklyn, and I still lived in Brooklyn, New York, and I would test in various schools. Sometimes these tests, and these days, depending on how many applicants there are, you know, normally I walk into a school, I'm looking for that sweet spot, about 6 or 7 applicants. If there's not enough applicants, something's wrong. Too many applicants, please, send them to the other issue. Those who walk in, they got this one day, and there's 17 applicants. They put you in a little janitor's closet with an oxygen tank, and you come out 20 hours later. So I was in this little janitor's closet, one after the other, like the 17th person you're in, just leave me alone. Just don't tell anyone you're in. Whenever you say, how did that guy get into yeshiva? He's probably 17. 11:30 at night. So I'm driving home at night, starving, because some places they're really kind to you, they bring you food. Some places, they'll slip it under the door, some whole PBJ sandwich. Oh, not again. You know, what's for lunch today? Pizza. Oh, that's a shocker. Pizza, 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 pizza. By the time I finish my trip, I don't want to see another piece of pizza. So, day's over, I'm absolutely exhausted and hungry. So I drive home, 11:30 at night, I stop off at a fast food shop that's still open, 11:30 at night in Brooklyn. I order my food, my hamburger, I think it was some rice or french fries or corn, whatever the side dish was. And literally as I'm eating there, I see people sitting at their feet on the table, throwing their french fries up in the air, tossing food around, like the bar scene from Star Wars. It was really creepy and weird people, just not acting. It wasn't a good scene. So I had a decision. I said, I'm not going to subject myself to this. And my dignity is more important than my stomach. And I just tossed the food into the garbage, and I went home hungry. I'd rather go to sleep hungry than go to sleep undignified. In this city, our own people, when you eat, you get a very, very tenuous part of your life because you're closer to the animal kingdom. You're grazing. Animals don't learn. When you're eating, you're like an animal. So to be careful to maintain as best you can your dignity. As best you can, obviously you're eating. To be careful. I try sometimes in hotels or stuff. I don't like waiting one line if the lines are too long. That's just because
just doesn't give me good feeling to wait and to frenzy and to get more food and put, just doesn't do well. At the time I wanted to treat food in a dignified. Now, this whole entry into that world of magic and darkness and animals and tails and hints and horns, and it's not good for your dignity. Try to, it's important to, not just to project it as if you project it, but to carry yourself with grace, to carry yourself like a prince, not in a way that's haughty, just the way you dress, your clothing should be clean, well laundered, your hair and your hygiene should be appropriate, your way of speaking. I'm sure by this point there are a lot of guys in high school screaming and shouting. What a scream, scream for Yeshmei Rambam, scream for Brech Zadar. They're not screaming at people from across the hall, and not shouting and going to the person they talk to. Again, if you're in a basketball court, you don't go to the person passing the ball, you want to space it for them. Go to the other end and scream for the ball. But it depends where you are, but at a beach then, you know. Guys, ain't easy to scream at it, you know, be careful. Be careful of the reef, be careful of the water. But so that's one reason. The second reason is because too much of an obsession with predicting the future can start to nibble away at your sense of empowerment to create that future. Because it really isn't a future. Of course there is a future. Of course HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows what you and I will decide and what tomorrow will bring. But that, since we don't know, it doesn't in any way crimp our free will of choice. The future is whatever you make of it. That's 7:15. Tomorrow will be whatever you make of it. And it could be a day that you totally waste and watch YouTube videos in your room. It could be a day that's you and the kind of it's us. You get up and daven and learn and perform chesed and try to be with people as best you can. The whole day. No one knows. Of course Hashem knows. That's the dilemma. Hashem knows how can you be free, but we don't know, so it doesn't really make a difference. That's why I counsel boys and girls when they get married, one word don't use. Don't use this word. It's totally useless. Not only is it useless, it's harmful. I want to marry that person. Is she my bashert? How's that going to help you? Hashem knows who you're going to marry, but you have to make a decision based on traits, personality, frumkeit, looks, whatever those are being made. That's your bashert, one you pick. Chas v'shalom, you should make it as chalil of a chas. Most terrible idea in the world to make a decision whether she is or not your bashert. Bashert is who you end up choosing based on all the factors, rational, practical, helpful, they just take into account. It's just misleading. It's confusing. So the same thing, what? I'm trying to decide what happened tomorrow. Rather than rights. Source number of days in the back. Rishos L'chol Adam Nisun, my famous Rambam, beginning of Parakim. Absolute, unfettered freedom of choice. At the core, Yiddishkeit. I know some of the NTA boys weren't here in Elul, but we're really going to talk about this a lot in Elul, and freedom of choice, and Tshuva being the boldest implementation of freedom of choice, not just to change your decisions, but to change your identity, become a different person. In Ratzalatas, Asmi Uber Koba, Yod Sade, Rishus Biyado, Ratzalatas, Asmi Uber Rasha, Rishus Biyado. Al Yavar B'mach Shaftecha, the Rambam says, line number 5. Don't think, Dabar Zash, Jarman, Tishim, was all the idiots say. Predetermination and Calvinism, Tzadik or Masha, Elakaladam, very, very aspiring statement. Royal of Tzadik and Moshe Rabbeinu. Imagine that. Every one of us in this room was born with Moshe Rabbeinu potential. Probably lost it one second to our lives, because our father was an Amram. And we've been falling off of the Moshe curve since we were born. But freedom of choice is so unfettered and so uncontainable, you need to be like much for a painter. Of course, you can sing to your rabbi. It's not just, some people say, well, you know, I have freedom, but my freedom is constrained by certain realities. No, it's unlimited freedom. I told you this before, I think your generation feels the world is very, very small, rigid. Don't fall prey to that. You can change the world. You can change your narrative. You can change who you are. It's a little selflessness, takes a little courage, takes a lot of hard work. It seems very large. It's not as large and powerful as it looks for a great team. It's just the human beings, and not that human beings create less. It's all just shifts and movements. And the Rambam quotes the three psukim in Echa, which we're reading tomorrow. Source number 8. Three psukim. This is the greatest synopsis of freedom of choice in the entire Tanakh. Source 8.
Hashem doesn't determine good or bad. Look at the underlying part of the Rambam. The Rambam quotes this. You are totally free to determine your fate. Therefore, because of that, next pasuk, if you fail, it's on you. Not because the Kodesh Baruch Hu created limitations and because of your circumstances and your conditions. It's easier to live in a predetermined world because you can acquit yourself of culpability. You can exonerate yourself. Well, I'm not really in my place or my station or the opportunity my last thing wasn't. It didn't have 1,000 excuses. It's justification. What happens if it's all on you? What happens if you throw out the freedom? It's a real way to live life, culpability. Real people who live really meaningful lives don't mind taking responsibility for failure. That's woven into life. Self-deceiving people who can't face themselves and their limitations always look to blame other people. Just had this conversation with one of my younger children. Don't look to blame other people. Take your life into your own hands. Focus on the things you can control and control. You're never going to be able to control anyone else in this world. Not your child, not your parents, not your siblings, not your wife, not your... Control what you can. Your response, your emails, your way of living, your values. It's the only thing you can control. You can cry baby, this person did this to me, this did this, did... You can take that room and just cry yourself to a fetal position. But just, well, I can't really control it. I can only control my own life, my own schedule, my own decisions, my own relationship, my coach. That's all I can do. I can't control anything else. I can't make anyone do things they don't want to do. Or become somebody I want to become. It's on you. The Ma'isar Eid Adam Chai, a person should cry and mourn, dear Baruch Atah. The Rav talked a lot about this pasuk. Imagine an Oneg. Oneg is a bereaved person. So it's an Oneg, it's like an Avel. Every time you fail, you become an Avel because you buried potential. You buried part of you that can't be reinstated. Think about people being an Avel because a family member dies. What about if you die? What about if you lose traction and part of you dies and because that potential is no longer available because you squandered it? You should cry. But you should also not fall into despair. That's the Rambam's conclusion because there's always a way out. So when Yirmiyah writes Eichai, he loops these three psukim together because it's not just a theoretical Bechira Chavshas. Bechira Chavshas creates culpability, also resilience and recoverability. And that's the second reason not to be involved in prediction, because predictions change our view of the world and start to delete our sense of freedom of choice or curtail it. You know exactly what's going to happen tomorrow, so I'm just going through the reps because it's all preordained and predetermined and pre-established. What a way to lead your life. Tomorrow's an open book. Tomorrow's an open road. You're going to write tomorrow's chapter. Of course, Hashem knows what you're going to write, but it's irrelevant. It's irrelevant. And then the final reason is something that Ramban talks about, but it's latent in the pasuk in Parshas Vayikra. We're back to pasuk in Re'eh. Source Gimel, Masimcha Mavir Beno, Bito, Ba'esh, Kosim, Samim, Onin, and Achesh, Machashev, Chavar, all these necromancers, sorcerers, wizards, Kirtu Ravas, Shemkulas, Eila, all these indigenous nations, they follow the black magic, and therefore Hashem expels them. Pasuk Yud Gimel, Tamim Tia Im Hashem Elokecha. Listen carefully. This is a really, really subtle point. At a certain point, obsession about the future and fear about the future, and preoccupation with the future. At a certain point, it's hard to know what that point is. It's different, but at a certain point, worry and panic and dread, talked about this in Shlach a little bit, it's a chisar nemar. If you feel that you're just ricocheting this world randomly without any supervision, without any control, and of course you're worried about the next ricochet, of course you're worried about the next random rebound. But is there room for a Kodesh Baruch Hu in this world? Is there room for a movement? Is there room for relying on Hashem? And no, that shouldn't make you oblivious to the future. That shouldn't make you responsible for the future. Well, Hashem's taking care of me. I'll go bungee jumping into a pool of sharks. And who cares? Who knows what's going to happen? After all, Hashem is watching. If you're following normal patterns of planning and behavior and responsible behavior and in some holidays, on the same token, this worry and fear and
heavens are falling. What's going to happen in Eretz Yisrael? It doesn't excuse us from having an army and from defending ourselves diplomatically. And there has to be a place for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You can't create that. And too much of that, and go and really climb into that world and see what tomorrow is. I don't know tomorrow, but just trust HaKadosh Baruch Hu tomorrow. I trust that HaKadosh Baruch Hu isn't allowing this world to run and to operate lawlessly without any supervision or without direction. It doesn't mean you should abdicate concerns for tomorrow. It doesn't mean you should abandon planning and precaution. But too much of an immersion, every decision you take, go consult those one-eyed witches or those sorcerers who are invoking the dead and tell us tomorrow. That's not the place of Imam. Imam says, I know one thing, I know two things. It's now July 10th, Wednesday. As far as I can tell, I'm living. I'm not into all that Greek philosophy. I don't really know I'm here. Pretty sure that I'm here. And the Kaddish Baruch Hu gave me life and breath and ability. I'll try to be the best Avodah Hashem I can. If he gives me life tomorrow, I'll come back for more. And whatever happens tomorrow, trust the Kaddish Baruch Hu. Trust the Kaddish Baruch Hu. It's not going to create a world of haphazard, serendipity, with clouds colliding with mountains and monsters roaming the earth and the earth shattering some meteor drip. Just like a Shabbat, but I think even if that happens, even apocalypse happens, it's just like a Shabbat. I mean, I'm not going to take efforts and steps, but so those are the three reasons that Nichosh is so fundamentally decayed. A, because it thrusts you into a world which is not where the Pasuk you before, but take a look at the Pasuk right before Bilam notices Am Yisrael's absence of Nichosh, Pasuk 1, so it's the wrong. We have to have the appearance, the sound, the friendship of the king. And then I'm skipping the pasuk, 2 seconds later, so Bilam at least recognizes that Bilam's world is hanging around with animals and blood and black magic and sorcery. So that, I wish I'd be in a cleaner world. I wish I'd be in a classroom. I wish I'd be in a bedroom and the dining room with normal people was eating my dinner, and then I had to roam the back forest and cut out open animals and drink their blood and speak to dead people in cemeteries. It's just not a life. Second issue is because it can nibble away at freedom of choice. Third issue is tell them to end the shame. We have 7 minutes. Okay. Seven quick minutes. What was Bilam's error? And Bilam makes such a mistake. To answer that, you have to take a sense of the degree of bracious flavoring in Parshas Balak. A lot of bracious. In particular, a lot of Avram and Lani Yaakov. Bilam's always mentioning Mimana Afar Yaakov, Kilo Nachash Bi Yaakov. All of a sudden, he's talking a lot about Yaakov. And he's talking a lot about Yaakov, not Yisrael. He says, Matovu Lecha Yaakov, Mishkin Osecha. He saw him mention Yisrael, but I'm talking Darach Kochav Miyakov. So he's obsessed with Yaakov. And his behavior mirrors Avram. Most directly gets up early, saddles his donkey. Someone of his stature isn't normally saddling smelling donkeys. It's like Avram gets up early and saddles his donkey. Many other parallels between Avram and Bilam and Chazal contrasted to a very famous mission in Avos, and I'll sense the parallel sometimes when you see Chazal coming up in this association, because they're really something careful. Call me Shiesh B'yad, I'll serve some Gimel, Shoshim Ram Halal, me Kamiyo Shalam Ram Gimel. So the following three traits are Avram's person, generosity, low spirit, humility, Bilam, anger, vitriol, always looking at the negative people, Ayura, pump, bombast, appetite, avarice, ruch, nivoa, nefesh, rechava, very haughty, one gold, one silver. There's a contrast between Avram and between Bilam. Bilam prays in the end of Tamos Nafshi, Mos Yisharim. I want to die like the Yisharim, because I'll see that it's a shadow to the Avos. The Avos will call the Yisharim, the gracious called Sefer Yisharim, because they built the world based on integrity and Yashrim, so that's how they constructed the world. So, well, why is Bilam so obsessed with the Avos? Why are you trying to outmaneuver Avram with his donkey and get up earlier than Avram? And he built 7 mizbechos, sorsan ruva, v'neili bozeh, 7 mizbechos, v'achili bozeh, 7 parim, v'shech 7, 7, 7, 1.
That's all I'll say, because he reads Brachus. And in Brachus, there are seven people who build Mizbechus. Adam builds a Mizbech, Hevel builds a Mizbech, Noach builds a Mizbech, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov build a Mizbech, and of course Moshe builds a Mizbech. So seven Mizbech people. Adam, of course, is the one that's not mentioned, but that's all. Seven Mizbechus, he's got to build seven. Why is he going back to Brachus and Mizbechus and Avraham and Yaakov? The answer is, Bilam had the following chiddush. And after all, he's a man of God, not an idiot. So what happened to the Egyptians, that's what frightened Balak. In last week's parsha, I'm just going to defeat Sichon and defeated Moab, the transitive law of military conquest. If he can conquer sea, then he can conquer B, then he can conquer C. So Sichon conquers Moab, and Am Yisrael destroys and decimates Amori. What is he going to overcome? What's terrifying? What's Bilam's angle? He's got some curses up his sleeve. I'm still got enough supernatural tools to offset those curses. What's his plan? His plan is to follow. They were chosen, but they forfeited it at the ankle. And they forfeited it in the rubble. They abdicated it for the last 38 years. And that's a new chapter in history. And they're no longer so chosen, no longer so vulnerable. Now I can get it. Now I can bank. So he's redoing Brachus. This is Brachus version 2. Let me undo their selection. Let me finally clinch the deselectedness, because this process of selecting them, driven by Yaakov, driven by the seven Nizbachos, driven by Avram, now I'm undoing it. Undo it, and at least offset it. They got to build their own Mizbechus. Then re-establish, maybe some new chosen, maybe no chosen, maybe everyone's equal. But they're no longer chosen, and they're no longer invincible. So now I'm redoing Brachus. And that's why he's so obsessed with their failures. Look at the Medrash source number Zion. Makov lo kavokel. How am I going to curse him when Hashem didn't curse him? You know what he's really saying? He's going to paraphrase. He's a big Russian. He says, even when they sinned in the Egel, Hashem forgave them. Even when they left in Israel, he still loves them. I was expecting him to curse them. These people are sinners. All Hashem talks about is not their oven, but their mitzvahs. Lo yibid oven b'yakov. He's frustrated. He says they had oven, they had ego, they had sins. Doesn't just wipe them off magically. Kara shakav kari. They crouched and they went to sleep and they got up again. I thought they were asleep. I thought the ego, they go to sleep early. All of a sudden they rise again. Bilam's learning the lesson that we may be trash in and we may suffer consequences and we may be expelled and we may be cut off communicatively for 38 years, but we're still Hashem's chosen people. That's the message of Bill, of Pasha's Balak. So basically, this is a parsha for the Mosul. Amisol doesn't even know what's happening. We didn't know about this conspiracy, nor about the. We're just going about our business, raising our livestock, eating our run, getting ready to move into Israel. All of a sudden, in the background, conspiracies and strategies and plans and hirings and curses and blessings and mizbechos. We don't even know what happened. Yes, the average Jew who Bilam was couldn't tell you his name until the war when we killed him. Couldn't tell you his name. This is a message to the Masalah that Hashem chose us, and that selection is paved in concrete. It doesn't change. There are oscillations and variations in our Jewish history, times of intimacy, times of distance, times of failure, times of success, triumph, betrayal, of course. If you want to see it differently, Bilam was the first Christian. Bilam was the first person to lodge the audacious claim of Christianity that you are no longer God's people. Because you could no longer argue our being selected. Before he mentions Yaakov's selection, Yaakov is one that engineers the selection. He's trying to undo the echo.
him as his adult, as a 10-year adult. Those are the three lessons. Then you get a full chance to flesh out the last. The first one is for beware of the seductive whisper that associates natural with holy. They're not overlapping. They're not contradictory, but they're not overlapping. It could be something which is natural and holy, but ipso facto is with sacred. Second issue is, why are we not into that whole world of magic and black magic? For three reasons. A, it's not dignified. B, the world isn't predetermined and predictable. And C, at what point do you just give it over to Dr. Sparkle? We're not worried and obsessed and dreadful. And then the final issue is those Bilam's plan. Bilam's plan is a different era. And they sin, and he learns and studies, and he realizes, lo, he bit out of the Akash. He doesn't care about it, doesn't care about it. It's not the game changer. It doesn't change the game, it doesn't change its life. It's not the seismic shift that they want to hope for. It doesn't re-landscape the world. It changes our relationship, but the selection is still there.
Okay, what's that?